They escaped the conquistadors and mated with the liberated of trappers, farmers, and settlers. Today they roam free in the prior mountains of Montana and Wyoming, where, they lead us to ask, should we allow room for wild horses?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 518th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Cairns who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Good morning.
And producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
And producer Carol Kelsey Olson back in town. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Folks, I was recently strolling the aisles of the Book Expo America in Washington, D.C., when the Book in Progress from Storybooks caught my attention, Among Wild Horses. What captured me was the cover photo of four extremely healthy-looking horses. I thought, these do not look like the wild horses at all. They look more like well-fed rodeo stock. Upon closer examination, I learned that Among Wild Horses would contain photos of the wild horses of the Pryor Mountains. Since I grew up stomping around the Pryor Mountains, I asked that a copy of Among Wild Horses be sent my way when completed. Well, it has been completed. So today, I ask you to join me for a trip into the Pryor Mountains of Montana and Wyoming for a visit with some truly magnificent wild horses. There, we will ask and seek an answer to the question of the day, which is, should we allow room for wild horses? Here to help us find the way, we have Rhonda Massingham, who is co-author of Among Wild Horses. Rhonda, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thank you.
So you're up there in Washington State? Is that where you're hiding out these days?
That's where the hideout is.
Okay. You're editor of horse magazines, and you write about horses.
Yeah, I'm kind of up to my eyeballs in the topic, but it was a real different world, actually, to go into their world in the wild. That was a real different experience.
Mm-hmm. And you went into that world with Lynn Pomerantz, who is the photographer for the book Among Wild Horses, right? You have a little partnership going.
Oh, yeah, I begged. I'll work for free. Just
take
let me,
take
come
me,
with
take
you.
Me with you. Well, that leads me to the question of the day. Well, one of the questions of the day, which is, why are girls so attracted to horses?
Yeah, that's an age-old question.
I know it is. So what's the answer?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with it's just a natural attraction to somebody that'll listen to us.
Uh-huh. Horses listen and boys don't, right?
So far, that's the experience. But there's uh-huh. also that magnetism, that draw of something so beautiful physically, spiritually. It just draws you in because they do listen, but they actually give you an opportunity to listen to them and interact. I mean, on all seriousness, there is something there indefinable because I grew up with it and can't seem to outgrow it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if anyone... Producer Carol Stafford says it's muscles.
And good hair.
Muscles and good hair. Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of wild horses and kind of fill us in a little bit because most of us, of course, are aware that there are wild horses around, but most of us probably don't know that wild horses were here before man was here, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, a long time before man was here. You know, it's funny because I grew up in the West Coast, and once or twice we took those, you know, required road trips in the 60s and early 70s, and one of them we went through Nevada, and my face was stuck to a window the whole time. Dad, is that a wild horse? Is that a wild horse? Mm-hmm. Where are the wild horses? Because that was during the time, I don't know if you remember Wild Horse Annie,
yeah.
But when it was coming to public knowledge that the wild horses were being wiped out, well, what we have learned since then is that, you know, they are native to the American continent. They're not native anywhere else. They're native here. They have been developing here for 57 million years. A little hiccup in between, because they did get wiped out about 11,000 to 13,000 years ago.
Any idea why?
You know, I know there are disparate theories on it, but, you know, look at it this way. People got here about 13,000 years ago.
And
it wasn't just the horses that got mysteriously extinct. It was also native elephant species and camels. And the same exact thing has happened in other, you know, parts of the world. And the classic example is New Guinea. You know, people show up and, gee whiz, all the native animals are gone.
Well,
but there's also, you know, there's also, to be fair, the other theories of ice age, et cetera, but there's been 17 other ice ages in the last 2 million years, and they all survived those.
But didn't people and horses get along, though? I mean, didn't people bring horses back to the American West?
Well, the thing is, when people arrived here, you know, right about the time of the ice age, that was a good 5,000 years before horses had been domesticated anywhere else. And at that point in our history, the only thing we could think to do with them was eat them.
Eat them, right.
And the fact that the horses here had not co-evolved with humans, they had no learned fear. A person could walk right up to a horse, you know, in all theory, because the horse is going to say, what are you? You're just a saggy little, you know, primate. You're nothing.
Yeah.
And whack them over the head, and there's dinner. So they didn't have that learned fear that they did have in the northwest Russian steppes or in Asia.
So they had no connection. And then the conquistadors, I guess, were the original cause of horses being reintroduced into the American West, right?
Yeah, it goes back to actually the second voyage. Columbus brought them into the Indies, and I think it was around 1530 that they actually started bringing horses up through you know, Mexico into the American Southwest.
And the, and these horses found a great environment, right? I mean, they're here's
the
these
native,
wonderful grasslands all over.
The Native Americans have a saying, and it's interesting because I guess it's been tracked to more than one area and more than one tribe, that the grass remembered them.
The grass what?
The grass remembered them.
Ah.
You know, it was their native home, and when they rediscovered it, they fit right in.
They fit right in, and there's the horses, and the... Indians and everybody got along really well until
well the system worked anyway
there was a time, you know, not too long ago when the horses were just overpopulated. I mean, they were everywhere. They were populating the plains. They were like buffalo,
you know. One of the things that I found really interesting is historians don't agree on counts because there was really nobody around to count them. Historian Frank J. Dobie cited that there were 2 million, but other people say that wasn't even close. It was 2-3 times that. But, you know, you get to read some of these really interesting diary entries from pioneers saying it took all day to cross the river because the wild horses were in the way. Even Lewis and Clark documented wild horses, and some they found as far west as what's now Oregon with Spanish brands on them, so you can tell where the, you know, the descent comes from.
So the horses literally took over the countryside again. And then, of course, when settlers moved in, the buffalo had to go, and the wild horses had to go as well, right?
That seems to be the way of it, yeah.
How'd they get rid of them?
In a word, slaughter.
They just slaughtered them, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was at one point a tremendous pet food industry, but that was well into the early 20th century. A lot of the time it was just shoot on sight and leave them where they were.
And this went on for a long time until?
Well, it went on up until the passage of the Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act in 1971, and honestly, I think to a degree it's still going on, only as a government-sanctioned action. It just isn't going on as overtly. But, you know, it's funny because when we passed that law, to me that's an extremely important law, not just because I'm a horse-crazy, you know, girl that never grew up, but because that was a law that was passed by the voice and the outcry and the involvement of the American people at a grassroots level.
What caused us to rise up and say, stop shooting the horses?
I swear, it really goes back to this Velma Johnson. They called her Wild Horse Annie, but she was just a rancher who was driving down the road one day and saw what she saw, horses crammed into the back of a truck, you know, bleeding and battered and peering out through the slats at her. And at one point, she actually followed the truck to the plant. And you know, this is this little slim gal that thinks she's going to take on, you know, guys that are wrangling wild horses, and she went and she tried to get help, and she eventually wound up speaking before Congress. But the biggest help she got was appealing to, you know, average, everyday Americans and saying, look, you don't know what's going on because you don't live here, but I have seen this. You know, and the problem with seeing for yourself and knowing firsthand is that you can't forget it. You know. And so they got kids to write letters. They got housewives to write letters. They got everybody that they could think of to write letters to Congress. And you've got to remember, this is pre-email, so you actually had to go out and buy a stamp. What were they then, 5 cents?
And so they passed the Wild Horse and Burro Act, which set aside certain areas of the country to protect the wild and free, right?
As it was worded, it was to protect them in the areas at which they were presently located.
Okay, and we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about one of those areas, Pryor Mountains, in the border of Montana and Wyoming, some of the most spectacular country in the world. And we're going to be doing it with Rhonda Massingham, who is the co-author of Among Wild Horses. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're interested to know what you think about the question of the day, which is, should we allow room for wild horses? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Saddle up out there. We're heading for the high country, the Pryor Mountains of Montana and Wyoming, with Rhonda Massingham, who is the co-author of Among Wild Horses. Rhonda, I was raised in the town of Billings, which is not too far away, and spent a lot of my time running around the Pryor Mountains in a 1947 Studebaker truck. But I was always looking for the wild horses that I heard were roaming the Pryor Mountains, and I saw a lot of horses, but they certainly didn't look wild to me. They didn't look scrawny or wild at all. They looked like they're pretty darn good shape. And so when I saw the cover of Among Wild Horses, and I saw these really healthy-looking horses, a kind of a mystery was solved for me. Why do these horses in the Pryors look so darn good?
I think you could attribute that a lot to good management. And, you know, by management, they don't take care of them, they don't feed them, they don't go out and brush the coat, but they try to keep the population, you know, at a level that is suited to the environment that they have.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the environment of the Pryor Mountains. Tell us about the area, since you have...
Well, you know it as well as I do. It's heaven on earth. It's the most gorgeous place I've ever been in. I grew up in the Cascades, so, you know, that's saying something. It's actually, the elevation kind of varies. They range from, you know, the lowlands where it's, what, around 4,000 feet up to almost 8,000, close to 88,000, I think. Those are approximate, you know, probably better than I do. But the horses take quite a bit of, they move around a lot. They can start down at the base of the mountain and be up at the top of it by that afternoon, and then be back down at the base of it again, you know, the next morning. They cover a lot of territory.
Being horses and all, right?
You know, that's just their natural tendency is to keep moving. And what's one of the controversies in management is that if they had adequate area, there would be a lot less evidence that they were even there, because they keep moving, and that way one area does not get grazed as much as if they, you know, are confined to a arbitrary space. The amount of land that's set aside for the Pryor Mountain Wild Horse Range has fluctuated quite a bit, I think, over the years. It started out right around 33,000 acres, and the last figures I had, it was over 39,000, but they acquire some areas, or they reach an agreement with other government agencies, because this area is administered by the BLM in Billings, but there are other land areas adjoining it that are public park or national park, and one of the nicest areas up there is part of the Forest Service, and that was, we didn't know a lot of this when we first got up there. We just went, ooh, pretty, and look, lots of horses.
Right.
But the Forest Service side is kind of towards the north, and just because of the geography of the mountains, that does get a little more rainfall, apparently. And it's lush, and it's green, and that's the part of the area that the horses aren't supposed to be on.
On the good part, right?
A big portion of it. Yeah. And that's part of the frustration with this particular you know, layout, is that a vast portion of that, and the BLM cites this in their own material, is not suitable habitat for horses. A lot of rocks and barren ground. So when they say they've got, you know, 30-some-odd thousand acres, you have to temper that with how much of it is rock.
Sure, and they have to graze at 16 miles an hour to stay alive, right? You know, for the folks who haven't seen it, the Pyre Mountains are a relatively small range of mountains right in the lee of the Beartooth Range of the Montana Rockies, due east of Yellowstone Park. You know, you go east of Yellowstone Park, you go down the Beartooth Highway, you cross the Clark's Fork of the Yellowstone River drainage, and then climb up the Pyre Mountains right there.
It's really something, because you think you're out of the mountains. You're seeing this vast red desert. There's nothing around but sagebrush as far as you can see, and then if you look through the cloud, there's this kind of beige lump. And you never know from the desert that you climb into those mountains, and it's such a glorious place. It's really a beautiful, beautiful area.
And speaking of the environment, it was borders the Crow Indian Reservation and has been used forever as hunting grounds, but also as holy lands, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't get to it both times I was up there at the wrong time of the year, but there is a site up there that was, and maybe still is, used for Vision Quest, and it's a stone chair that looks out over the big canyon, and we couldn't get to it because even in June there was still snow.
Well, when I was a high school kid, we did a lot of vision questing up there, too, but unfortunately, we did it with beer.
Yeah, it's a different kind of vision, huh?
Yeah, definitely a different kind of vision quest, I guess. So, incidentally, do you know how the Pyre Mountains got their name?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story, but it wasn't as interesting as I thought it was going to be when I dug into it.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, when the Lewis and Clark expedition were making their way from one coast to the other, they named things along the way for people that were part of their entourage, and Sergeant Pryor got to have the little bumps in the distance named for him. There's a story about when they were on their return trip that Pryor and a couple of the other fellows were supposed to take the horses, and I'm not even sure if I remember where they were supposed to take them. They were heading back with the horses, and they were supposed to deliver them to one of the chiefs or something. But, you know, they'd wake up in the night and there'd be three or four missing. They'd wake up the next night, there'd be half of them missing. And what they believed was happening was that the Crow Indians were taking them away.
Sure.
And that's one of the stories that kind of comes back, is, see, well, maybe that's one of the origins of how the horses got to the Pyre Mountains. But you kind of come to find out that they were really far away. I mean, I thought that they named the mountains for Sergeant Pryor because he'd actually been there, but he wasn't really.
No, he wasn't even close. He wasn't even close. You know.
It was a good story until you get to the background.
Yes,
of it.
I think what happens is that Captain Clark threw his name on a little creek that they passed by, Pryor Creek, and Pryor Creek, of course, originates in the mountains, which eventually, I guess, the name followed the creek up into the mountains, and the mountains became the Pryor Mountains as well as Pryor Creek.
There you go. That worked.
Nobody else could come up with anything better. Let's talk about the life of the wild horses, because, of course, you know, those of us who live in civilization, we see horses, and horses are in corrals, and they're standing there looking all forlorn, swishing their tail at the flies. And is that the way the wild horses live, too?
You know, at certain times of the year, yeah.
Yep.
There's a lot of flies up there in July and August.
Oh, boy. And they're mean, too, up there, aren't they?
Oh, my goodness. That's why we go when there's still snow.
Yeah.
Actually, I have to say, like I said, I begged Lynn to go, and she goes up there a lot more than I have. But, you know, so she knows the terrain a lot better, and she knows when to be where. And so when I'm kind of a fair-weather friend. I show up in June when I can either freeze or be warm, but I don't have to fight flies or too many tourists either. But this is not an easy place to get to. But the horses spend more time doing what looks to us like nothing. You know, we have these images of the dramatic fights and the galloping across the landscape, and, you know, they spend a lot of time just in tranquility. I mean, it's a very peaceful existence until something sparks a change. And their behavior patterns are, you know, they've been set over probably hundreds of years in that particular location, but, you know, thousands, 2 million for the species itself.
Well, tell us about the herd.
Well, okay, when we say herd, we're just talking cumulatively all the horses up there. The herd breaks down into several different bands, and that's not a static number.
So when we talk about the herd, we're talking about the Pyre Mountain herd,
which
is the population, right?
Yeah. I don't have the latest figures in front of me, but it's varied. I mean, there's, I think, about 180 horses up there now, and they try to keep it. One of their prerogatives came out that said plus or minus 10% of 95, which was way too low. I think that's the number. I may be misquoting, but they're right around 180 at this point, and they break down into these little groups. And up until very recently,
what do you call the little groups?
They refer to them as bands, but there could be as many as six, seven, eight. Which in most areas that have wild horses, the bands are larger. But there's a reason why they tend to be smaller in the priors. They tend to have more stallions left in the priors than they do in other regions. That's a management issue, and you know, there's some that don't like it, but the point behind it is trying to maintain as much genetic variability as they can by keeping more stallions on the range.
So that really has an impact on the social situation,
doesn't it? It has quite an impact on the social interactions, the behavior, and the family bands, because there's a lot of frustration with, you know, the bachelor stallions trying to get to marriage. One of the things that we witnessed when we were up there that's in Lynn's book was there was this stallion who was obviously lame, and he was circling this band trying to get towards the mares, but there was another stallion who was higher in rank than he was, so he had first dibs to be circling this band, and here was the band stallion trying to keep all these other guys away from his girls, you know.
So, well, you know, I once had a Shakespeare professor that said, look here, Olson, all of the good stories are about fighting or fornicating. So I guess the wild horses of the Pryor Mountains, there's a lot of that going on, right?
Yeah, they can combine the two.
Combine the two. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Rhonda Maskingham. We're talking about the wild horses of the Pryors and the book, Among Wild Horses. Question for you today. Do you think we should set aside room in our rapidly populating world for wild things like wild horses? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Welcome back out there. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain radio program. Today we're talking about wild horses of the Pryor Mountains with Rhonda Maskingham, who's the co-author of Among Wild Horses. We're talking about the social life of horses, of the wild horses, when we left. And of course, those of us who have been around horses quite a bit have a vision of what horse life is like here in civilization. It's quite a bit different out there in the wild. And we're talking about the herd and how the herd is broken down into families called bands. And Rhonda, one of the stories that I found fascinating was a story of the band of horses. When you look at Among Wild Horses, you see a lot of different horses in there, and you think, my goodness, it must be a very multicultural world up there in the Pryor Mountains among those wild horses. Do they have a lot of genetic diversity? Is it manifest in the horses themselves?
They are working towards maintaining that, and there's been some pretty key people involved with that, from geneticists to the people that run the Billings BLM. But you know what I find interesting is all these wild horses up there, they break into these little bands, they come together, you know, in groups, not necessarily the whole herd at one time, because that's a lot of horses in one place, but they're all over the place. But what I find interesting is that these guys have known each other, most of them, of course, their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
So they find their roles within this group, and each little group has its own hierarchy within the larger herd.
And then they all come together at the water hole, and what happens?
They do. And it's really fascinating to watch, because when Len and I first got up there, you know, we were lucky to get there alive the way we were doing things anyway. But when we found the horses, we didn't know where anything was. We didn't have really a map to find anything other than this little cabin. So forget, you know, the horses or trails or water holes. When we finally found one band of horses, we sort of kind of fell in behind them, you know, within, say, a quarter of a mile, because we didn't know if they were going to run away from us or run at us, so we were keeping our distance quite a bit. But we just followed them, and they showed us where the water hole was.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get to the water hole, it's the higher group that gets to go in first, and it's the higher individual within that group that actually gets to go splash in the water. So you can see who's who just by watching who drinks, who splashes, who rolls, who gets to play in the water first.
And then who gets to drink the dirty water, right?
Yeah, pretty much. They're not that different from us.
I guess not. Tell the story of the band that really closely resembles the horses that date back to the conquistadors.
Well, a lot of them do, actually. And, you know, there's...
How do you tell? What do they look like?
There's been a lot of controversy about that, and there's less now among scientists, but see, that hasn't filtered down to the rest of us. But what they look for, originally they did blood typing, and blood typing will pick up markers. And, you know, when you've got like 30,000 genes in the horse genome, so when you pick up a few, quote-unquote, Iberian or Spanish markers, that may not mean a whole lot. You may not have any of those particular markers that we have been able to trace in a very Spanish-looking horse. So we can either go by the blood typing, we can go by DNA analysis, which is a lot stronger evidence, but it's kind of hard to tell that when you're just standing out in the wild looking at a horse. So what we look for are certain conformational attributes. They tend to have a Spanish look, and that comes down to kind of the, oh, they call it the Iberian or Spanish head, but they've got a convex to straight nose. They have very full manes and tails. Some of it's color. They have a lot of duns, grullas, and blacks, which are very consistent with Spanish coloring.
Mm-hmm.
These horses have some other things that are a little bit different. There's typical Spanish things also are things like you can't see the little chestnuts, the little piece of bone-like material that shows on the legs. These horses have very small ones, or in some cases they don't have them. That's another consistent Spanish thing. But there are bloodlines up there that are not so Spanish, and you see that in things like feathers on their fetlocks, so like the long hair like the Clydesdales have.
Right.
In different coat patterns that, well, we may or may not be able to associate those with a Spanish background, but, you know, whether or not this is a pure Spanish herd, and most people agree that they're not a pure Spanish herd, but that there is Spanish background there, you know, they're as wild and original to that area as any wild herd anywhere, and it's kind of one of the reasons I think I fall in love with this so much, because they are as American as the rest of us. Their ancestors came over on a boat. They have mixed, you know, heritage. They have had to make do with where they found themselves with whatever they could find to do it. I mean, to me, that's the great American success story in a nutshell.
And they're surviving.
Yeah, they do really well. You know, they have a lot of range that they cover that has been their historic range that they're not supposed to be on. But, see, they don't see the lines that we draw.
Right.
There are fences in some areas, and then one edge of it's bordered by the Bighorn River, so they don't cross the river, because you've seen it, there's huge canyons in those places. But when they manage to what's called trespass into some of the better, you know, feeding ranges, they manage very well. This is a unique herd. They are not competing with grazing cattle. Most other wild herds that are on BLM land are competing with, you know, cattle that graze under public license, basically. You know, ranchers pay a fee, and their cows and sheep could go out and eat, but the horses are sneaking around stealing their grass. That's pretty much how they look at it. So these guys don't have to do that.
That's their land. It's been set aside for them, right?
Yeah.
Let's go quickly to, you know, you mentioned something very interesting with respect to the management of horses, and that is the BLM people are keeping a high percentage of stallions, perhaps even more stallions and mares.
There were when we were up there. They just had another, they refer to as gather,
mm-hmm.
and they did take quite a few stallions off the range, so I think we're back to having a few more mares than stallions. But the interesting thing is, when you say that this land is set aside just for them, that's only as far as competition with
other horses.
For-profit grazing, yeah, because they do have to balance it with everything from people on four-wheelers to bighorn sheep to, mm-hmm. you know, cougars, which you know about the cougars taking the foals, so that's part of the natural balance.
Yes, so they have to protect the land for the mountain lions, and which means that they feed on the wild horses, right?
Yeah, they're a lot easier to catch than wild deer and sheep.
Well, before we go to the break, a quick question. Do wild horses have their own kinds of diseases, like the spongiform encephalopathies, like chronic wasting disease or something, anything like that?
We're not seeing that. We're not seeing that in these areas. You know, that's something that I can't really speak to with any degree of, you know, expertise, but the big issue up there right now as far as human intervention is population control, and they're using something called PZP to accomplish that.
Oh, good. That'll be a perfect segue for what Bill wants to talk about on the line when we get back from this break. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Rhonda Massingham, we're talking about among wild horses, the wild horses of the Pyra Mountains up there in Montana, Wyoming. Do stay tuned, right back. Water users, you can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and get rid of calcium carbonate deposits. No, not by magic. By installing an Aquamax catalytic converter in your water line that will induce epitaxial nucleation. Listen.
My name is Dave. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada. Well, my pool maintenance is virtually none. There's no scale buildup on the tile whatsoever. I just take a damp cloth every so often and wipe the tile down, and that's as much work as I have to do. I don't have to aerate my lawn at all now. I just fertilize once in the spring and once in the fall, and that pretty much maintains my lawn.
You can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and eliminate calcium carbonate deposits just by installing an Aquamax on your water line. No chemicals, no filters. Explore the possibility. Go to MetroFarm.com, click on the Aquamax Water Saver banner, and save. That's MetroFarm.com.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, we're back. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. Today we're talking about the wild horses of the Pryor Mountains with Rhonda Massingham, author of Among Wild Horses. And we're also going to talk with Bill, who has some comments with respect to the amount of land it takes to manage wild horses. Bill, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good to have you aboard, Bill.
Thanks.
And Bill's a Montana cowboy. Got his start in life by wrangling horses, right?
That's right, yeah. Well, Michael, my position is pretty much the same as almost anybody that's experienced in ranching and land management. It's a case of grazing and overgrazing.
Right.
I feel that we must preserve ranges for the wild horses. I think they're part of our heritage, but I also think we must not try to graze them on, like in some parts of Nevada that I'm familiar with, the Dayton Flats and whatnot, where Misfits was filmed,
mm-hmm.
where you get these really poor horses that are, they're just almost skin and bones, you know? So my point for you is, and for Rhonda, is basically, As long as we can have free range for the wild horses, managed much like the elk refuge in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where in the case of a severe winter they can come down for feeding,
mm-hmm.
and in other parts of the Southwest, in case of a severe drought, where there's some provision for if they're going to have a wild horse range, that then they should have provision for feeding those animals during periods of severe drought.
Well, Bill, let me go right back to the fundamental question of why should we set aside land for wild horses? I mean, elk you can understand because people hunt elk and there's a food chain built around that, but wild horses just seem to be wild horses.
Well, anybody that's ever owned a horse would disagree with you that as far as I'm concerned, they are part of our heritage, as I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think, you know, we have to overdo the land that's set aside for them. But I think just as we set aside land for the parks, that the wild horses deserve their place as well.
Mm-hmm. And if we get rid of them, then we get rid of part of ourselves too, don't we?
Absolutely.
Rhonda, what do you think?
You know, Bill brings up two really good points. I mean, I sure appreciate what he said about the feeding of the elk, because one of the management issues with the BLM is that they do not feed these wild horses. In 1978, out of a population of about 150 or so, 75 horses died due to cold and starvation. And, you know, local residents there out of Lovell, Wyoming, were trying to bring them up hay, but you got to realize this is in the mountains in Wyoming and Montana. Just getting the hay there was no easy thing. And, you know, when they have this low of a population density and you have another catastrophe, a drought or, you know, severe winter, or like the predation they had in 2004 where every foal but one was killed, they don't account for that. And, you know, I'd love to see the BLM come to some kind of an agreement that they would be able to make some sort of, you know, in drastic times, take some action. But so far they don't, and I'd love to see them do that. The other point he brought up was making sure that the land set aside for horses is adequate but not extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at, there's something like 260,000 acres of public land that are being used. We've rationed the horses off to such a small amount of it. I'm sorry, 260 million acres. And we've got cattle, 4 million cattle. We've got sheep, about 2 million sheep. But we've got it down right now to about 26, 28,000 horses. You're telling me there's not room for horses on some more of this land, but there's room for for-profit grazing. That really seems like a sad set of priorities to me.
And it seems like the less land that we set aside, the fewer horses we can support.
And especially when they set aside land, like what Will was talking about, in the desert, horses are not necessarily adapted to desert life, nor
the
are they necessarily
far side of the moon.
Yeah, well, and you know, you look at the priors, that's subalpine.
Yeah.
They've adapted very well to that because they've had a lot of generations to do it without these other pressures. But when we've driven horses to the farthest edge of the desert, and then we complain that, well, they're not very pretty, and there's too many of them, and they're eating everything out there, that's not the horse's fault.
Right. And again, you know, the fewer number of acres that we dedicate to this, the fewer horses we can support. And the fewer horses we support, the more likely we are going to lose the population entirely should something happen. Does that ring true to you, Bill?
Yes, I think so. You know, I do want to point out that it is not impossible to what I call gentle break a wild horse. And some of the
Mustangs, that's an interesting.
I've had experience breaking some Mustangs, and I can tell you they can turn out to be damn good horses.
Mm-hmm. Even girls can do it. I've been there too.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
what do you
even
mean you
girls
can't?
they're better at it than men are.
What do you mean
kidding?
You can't gentle break them? What does that mean?
Well, you don't use violence. You don't. You try not to let them buck if you can prevent it. But you sure as heck don't expect to do it overnight either. It takes a little more time to break a wild horse than it does a domestic raised horse, you know.
Well, Bill McGee, thank you so much for tuning in with us, and best of luck on your book, The Divorce Seekers.
Hey, and I just read the galleys on your new book. I am really excited about that.
Oh, thanks, bud. Folks, this is The Food Chain. We're going to come back with Rhonda. We're going to talk about the future of wild horses and what we can do, you and I can do, to lend a hand. To stay tuned, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Wild horses. Couldn't drag me away. From the Wild Horses book, Among Wild Horses, by Lynn Pomerantz, photographer, Rhonda Massingham, writer. What a fun job that must have been, putting that book together. Rhonda, do you have fun doing that?
For
running around the Pryor Mountains?
Yeah. You know, there's an old saying, fools rush in, and we went places we probably shouldn't have and did things we probably didn't know any better than to do, but we came back alive and had some great pictures to show for it. Basically, you know, the reason for the book was because we were like everybody else and kind of, you know, sadly accepting the demise of the wild horse because they were just so unhealthy and so sickly. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we saw what we saw, you can't unknow it. And so we wanted to share that. We wanted people to know that this herd does look like this and are living very healthy and dynamic lives, and that others could, too, if the management issues were brought about the same way.
Well, you know, in looking at some way of preserving the wild horses, and especially the wild horses of the prairies, you know, you look at some way of bringing them to the attention of people. And, of course, there's been movies and documentaries and whatnot. But is there a way for tourists to view the wild horses of the prairies without going up there where I went in my 1947 Studebaker truck?
There is. Thank goodness there is, because part of the range encompasses what's called the Bad Pass Highway. And for a day pass, and I think they were $5, you can drive through this part of the, it borders the Bighorn River. And there's beautiful canyons. And I mean, some of the photos we got were practically on the road, because some of the horses sometimes will come that close to the road. It's their territory. They're acclimated to it. The traffic doesn't bother them because people don't harass them.
Right.
So you can drive about, I think, 14 miles, 10, 14 miles out of Lovell, Wyoming, and, you know, view them from the road. I mean, you can get out and walk around if you want to, but you don't have to, and you certainly don't have to put your life at risk like we did.
It's kind of like viewing the wolves in the Lamar River Valley of Yellowstone Park, though, right? You can drive right along the road and get out with your binoculars and check it out.
Yeah, and it's so fun, because the other thing you get to do is see the other people that are there sharing that experience with you.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a moment, and I know we're starting to run short on time, I wanted to read you something very brief, because I found this has a lot of impact.
Okay.
This is part of the Wild Free-Roaming Horses and Burros Act of 1971. And it states, Congress finds and declares that wild free-roaming horses and burros are living symbols of the historic and pioneer spirit of the West, that they contribute to the diversity of life forms within the nation and enrich the lives of the American people, and that these horses and burros are fast disappearing from the American scene. It is the policy of the Congress that wild free roaming horses and burros shall be protected from capture, branding, harassment, or death, and to accomplish this, they are to be considered in the area which they are presently found as an integral part of the natural system of the public land.
So this is the law passed in 1977.
1971, but yeah, and that was something else I kind of wanted to throw at you, is that, you know, the Prior Mountain Reserve was set up prior, no pun, to that law. It was set up actually in 1968, and that again was through the impetus of the local people there in Wyoming and Montana demanding that they be set aside and not run off of the property. And, I mean, they really had some go-arounds with the government officials, but in the end, people persevered.
Well, what is it, in closing here, Rhonda, what is it that those people of Wyoming and Montana, what is it that they love so much about wild horses?
I think those horses are a part of them as much as they're a part of the horses. Their histories converge, and they respect what it takes to live in that environment because they do it themselves.
And there's a little bit about living wild and free that all of us miss too, isn't there?
When you are among wild horses, you feel you are in their world. You understand how they relate to each other, and they tolerate you, and that is an extremely wonderful gift.
Can we save them? Can we, you know, generate enough interest among the populations of the cities of our country to...
I hate to say it, but I think part of it has to do with people being able to tear themselves away from all our other little, you know, daily concerns. Really, do you have time in your day to worry about this?
Yeah.
And part of what I think helps people to look at that is recognizing that there is something so valuable about their perseverance, about their daily lives, about, you know, how they live their life, that I think we kind of like to compare to ourselves. I'd like to, if I could, give you a couple of other resources for people.
Sure, you have 30 seconds to do it.
There is a video out by highplainsfilms.org in Missoula, Montana, called El Caballo, E-L-C-A-B-A-L-L-O, El Caballo. And there are a couple of websites that are...
Google Wild Horses, right?
Yeah. There's one called the American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign, another called Return to Freedom.
And go ahead and Google those. Folks,
yeah.
Thank you so much for... Rhonda, thank you so much for joining us today. What about it out there? Should we allow room for wild horses? Log your answers to the forum at metrofarm.com. Best answer wins a copy of Among Wild Horses. See you all next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. Thank you, Rhonda.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.